Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Bhutang dhammang sangkhang namasami. So, it's our last evening together. It's been one of the quietest meditation retreats I've ever had the good fortune to sit through with. Very impressive, isn't it, when so many of us can just settle down and go for it. Very inspiring, isn't it? And how a community can live in a communal way and yet in a very individual. You know, how we all have our own program that we're sort of working on, and yet we can support each other. And this is, of course, extraordinary to be able to live in silence like this, because monastic life isn't silent, and there's lots of talking. So it's extraordinary, but I feel very fortunate to be a part of this. And returning to the real world. That's the phrase, isn't it? The real world. And then people ask, well, how do I do it, Bhante? How do I do it in the middle of a whatever? And I always say, I don't know. Of course, where someone like me, who I when I sort of met Buddhism and when I figured out what it meant, in some sense I had no alternative but to take the road. Partially reluctantly, because I knew what that entailed, but when I figured it out, and unfortunately I had the freedom to do it, and sort of inspiration. So anyway, I've never really had a lay practice. I've never practiced Dhamma in a relationship as such, or had kids, or had a job. I had said when I was like 10 years old or something to my parents, I'm not working 9 to 5. I don't remember. So anyway, one day my dad was speaking with my mom. I'd been a monk for about 5 years, and dad turned to my mom and said, he's done it. So quite often some of the best advice is really among fellow lay practitioners. How do you handle family life? What do you do with pressures at work and money and so on and so forth? But you do have a momentum now, don't you? So you've been doing 10 days together. You've had to endure. Usually, most people have probably had to endure a few days of restlessness, dullness, physical pain, and just to kind of enter into the practice. Usually practice kind of just clicks in on the fourth day or something for many people. And that's, of course, settling the mind down from the busyness of whatever's been happening in family life. So how do you keep the momentum going? That's the challenge. Well, I think one thing you have to remember that because lay life sometimes is there's so much sense input, and there's so many things maybe you're dealing with at the best of times, that the first part of a sitting is kind of like the first 4 days of the retreat. You quite often just to sit down, you've got a lot of restlessness or negativity that maybe that you have to work out just to get down on the cushion. And so what happens typically as life becomes more complicated and more busy, people sit less. And it's not simply a matter of not having time. I think it's also just that the mind then builds up its tendencies towards restlessness and dullness and all that. And then to actually sit down with that, you just don't want to go through it. And so there's more and more reluctance to sit. And of course, the more reluctant one is to sit, then the more there's the accumulation of that kind of scattered mind, jaded mind. And so it sort of perpetuates itself until one's not sitting anymore. And then one just kind of walks around feeling guilty when you see me. How's your practice? You say, well, I'm working on it. but it's a very, it's a common difficulty, the discipline of meditation. I think partially because there is a, there's the kind of negativity you have to sit through. It's not like kind of like reading a Dharma book, inspiring Dharma book is a lot easier than sitting down and meditating. Kind of, you say, oh wow, look at this one, it's Ramdas again, wow. And so that's good because it can inspire your heart, but the real guts of the work of sitting with a bored mind, or you're really sleepy or dull, that's hard. But if you don't keep a daily practice, it's like you haven't taken your shower. So you don't take a shower every day, you don't have many friends after a month. So you got to take your shower. You got to do your kind of, what do they call it, maintenance work. Maintenance work, at the very least. So how do you do that? One good way, should one have a huge house with lots of space, is to have a shrine room. Or a kuti in the garden. If it was possible. Or at least a corner in the room. Well, if you're living alone, then it's much easier. But if you're living in the family, it's more difficult. But, if you have a... like this room here, it kind of does part of the work for you, doesn't it? You come into the space and the mind settles. Just the Buddha group of the silence. And I get a lot of joy of just bringing tradespeople in here. People who have no real inclination to meditation or Buddhism, but I just kind of bring them in, and I try to bring as many people as I can. So when we put in this new plumbing, I brought the plumbers in, and it was just before Christmas, and they were busy, 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 and you could just see them, oh, wow, the peace, just the settling of the mind. So that's really what a shrine room can do, a little meditation room. And I know that's not always possible, but keep it in mind if you're moving house. Or kuti, a little hut in the woods, in the forest. So there's environment. And it one's own home is kind of, can be notorious for just signaling all the things you should do. You should fix this, you should fix that, you should take care of this, you should take care of that. And yeah, it's true, but you should also sit. So if you don't have a space or a Buddha Rupa or a quiet corner that reminds you of that, it's a bit more difficult because the whole house is reminding you of other things. That's also why people come to, go to church, because church is that kind of space where you can be silent. Again, I don't know how you do that, but groups are very good. So like I know the Toronto group have a really good program, and most of the groups I visit have a day of mindfulness once a month. That's really good. And I think the Toronto group meets twice a week, right? Depends. Once or twice, but even that, in a big city, that's very difficult because all the travel time. But just quite often, like-minded people who are sitting together. So even if you have three or four, if you find it difficult to sit on your own, And just two or three people sitting together is good, because you know you don't want to disappoint your mate, because they're going to arrive for the sitting, so you'll arrive for the sitting. But in general, to try to keep a daily discipline of it's not so much just the sitting, it's the stopping, isn't it? It's not just kind of doing your zafu kind of number, but it's actually breaking the habit of becoming and doing and getting finished and all that, and filling the mind also, like distraction. Much of the kind of dullness of the mind and the sort of jaded nature of the mind is just too full. It's stuffed full with information and all kinds of sense experiences. And none of that is necessarily immoral. It's just too much. Just too much.
Is there a minimum, I guess, time period?
For sitting?
Yeah, it's like that. It's just coming out of the treatment.
Well, you do have a momentum now, right? So you just look at your own patterns. Say, how if you've had a busy day, right? Usually 15 minutes just to get settled down, probably. If you look at what happens to the mind, and then as you're getting settled in, you want that kind of settled state of mind to hang in for a while. Don't you? So you want to be with that for at least 15, 20 minutes. So ideally 2 hours every morning, 2 hours every evening. But ideally, as an aside, I wouldn't set a time where I'd think, well, I can't do that much, so I'll do it tomorrow. That's the danger of setting a minimum time. Just say, well, a minimum time of an hour, you got 45 minutes and I'll read the newspaper. That would be self-defeating. But if you didn't set a minimal time and just, you know, kind of, well, it's been 6 minutes, I mean, it's good enough. so it's like trying to set a discipline which is not forced, isn't flexible, but, you know, where you really kind of get to it. So I would say I wouldn't do less than half an hour, because it does take a while just to kind of settle into the thing. And if you can introduce some devotional side, you know, something that either the metta practice or Bhutanasati, the reflection on the Buddha, or if you have another teacher or another tradition, it doesn't really matter so much, where the heart really gets that feeling of loving surrender, of gratitude, that really helps. I mean, I think you've noticed that in the retreat, how helpful that can be. And so those kinds of tools of like gathas, poetry, or some kind of calming music or chanting that you do, leads you into the right state of mind. Right? That's very, very helpful. Now, notice how the way memory works, how when you have song or chanting or repetition of a word or something like that, how that, if it's wholesome and you've done it for a while, it will remind you of those wholesome states of mind, right? So I had a lovely insight into that when I was, you know, and I often talk about this, but there was a woman who used to come here before this was built, when we were up top there. She'd been fighting cancer for about 7 years. And really kind of vibrant, brave being. And so she was into the last phase of her life in the Wellington Hospice. And I went in about 24 hours before she died, and I ended up staying there 24 hours, but I didn't know it at the time. But anyway, in that last 24 hours, her bones began to decompose, or would fall apart, and the calcium started to go into the blood, and she started to get delirious. I think that's the medical way it works. But anyway, she started to become delirious, and she said, "Oh, what am I going to do now? I'm really losing it." And then I tried to explain to her what to do, and you know, just I tried to use language, which is intellect. She couldn't compute, just couldn't, you know, wasn't going anywhere. So what am I going to do now? So I started just to chanting. And she had been coming here every Thursday for quite a few years. And she remembered the chanting, and the memory of the chanting reminded her of peace. And you could just see her mind settle. Because although the, you know, there were kind of delirious states of mind or whatever, what I surmise happened was she touched something deeper, the sense of acceptance to the difficulty she was having. That was a lovely insight into how a practice of devotion or chanting or whatever has this kind of profound karmic possibility, because it's something that's been encouraged in the mind, trained into the mind. And so these ways of returning to wholesomeness through the use of language, of song, really. So you can see, if you have some form of chanting or whatever, and you really do it with sincerity, how that can have great benefit. And again, it doesn't have to be Buddhist per se. It's just understanding how the mind works. Vice versa, if you look at how memory works, if you are continually being pulled through wrong thinking into memories which are very destructive or negative in any way, you can see how, if you don't learn to break those memory patterns, then that's what you constantly get reborn into. And I think there comes a time in all that kind of memory work where the very difficult memories that we do have, and sometimes they take a long, long, long time to work out, but that there comes a time in the arising of those difficult memories, you smile, because you realize, oh, that's just a memory. What a relief. Now that might take a few years to get there, if you have a very, very traumatic situation or whatever. So the understanding of memory, understanding of how memory which is conjoined with unwholesome states of mind, one needs to be very careful of, and that one can develop the memory of the wholesome and bring that to consciousness and then sustain that. So memory is a very important thing in understanding the mind. And so if you have a place in your house and a time and a situation and chanting and imagery like a Buddha rupa or whatever you like that reminds you of that, then those are all kind of aids in coming to that sense of peace. And you know, theoretically you could meditate in a pub, but there are a few distractions going on. You could stay centered in the pub, but you know, if you just take a kind of extreme consideration of that. So like, if you can begin in the morning, like I said one morning, remember I said, where was your heart at this morning? And what kind of thoughts were there the first thing you woke up? And what kind of, and what mood did those thoughts indicate? Was it a kind of oppression of your heart? Did you wake up with a Monday morning mind? Now that's memory going on. And you find sometimes you wake up in the morning and you're tense from the dream world. Wow, look at that. I've had a sleep and I'm still tense. And this is sometimes happens when our minds are very, very much caught up. But if you really awaken to what's going on, and even if you don't meditate, if just when you're having your coffee and bun or whatever you do, rather than kind of listening to the radio and thinking of all the things that you're going to need to do today, you'll have to think about that eventually. But first and foremost, while you're drinking your coffee and you're having your bun, what's your heart doing? And what kind of thoughts are there? And what's the mood of the mind? Because if you can suss that out, and right there, get back to right attitude, get back to relaxing into the heart, then you don't come into the day with this wrong conditioning. But you can see if in the morning one, it kind of gets into this awful rushing to that whole incredible list of things you have to do, and maybe you have to do them, no doubting it, but already you're into that, then it, you know, at the end of the day, you've created a lot of very, very oppressive karma for the heart. And then if you can, I think if you could make an exercise, I was thinking about today, what kind of exercise would I try to do in a busy, 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 busy life? Well, one of the things I try to do is, of course, get fired. But if that didn't work, then I think the exercise I would do is to try to do rather than to finish. To do the thing rather than get it done. Because I was just watching these emails that I was typing yesterday, and I could see how, because the heart's really open right now, I could see how just trying to get it done, just that little bit, oppresses the heart. And then I was kind of extrapolating, seeing if you've got your kind of really heavy agendas, you're trying to get finished, and you're just rushing around. I mean, your heart's just going, it's just kind of this heavy weight. So but you still have a list of things that you have to accomplish. So obviously, try not to make big lists. try to simplify. But if you can't, whatever you have to do, then really try to really make it a practice of just doing the present moment. Because it's not necessary. You get it done just as fast. But really look at that mind, which is always trying to get rid of this one in order to get to the next one, in order to get rid of this, that one, to get, because that's very, very bad for the heart, isn't it? It's not immoral, but the heart will get more and more, less and less joy. And you'll never really be with what you're doing, because you'll always be trying to get rid of this one in order to get to the next one. Just look at, like, when you have a happy possibility, but to get to the happy possibility, you have to kind of get through the mundane reality. Then because you have the happy possibility in your mind, where you're going, who you're going to see, the thing you're going to eat, or the theater you're going to go to, and all that, which is maybe 4 hours down the road, then everything in the way, as it were, you have to get rid of it, right? And there are kind of these obstacles, bang, 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 so I can get and do the thing I really want to do. Well, that 4 hours of banging away all these things you don't want to do, what does that do to the heart? Makes it absolutely miserable, actually, and jangled. But so obviously there's some things we prefer to do more than others, but the more we can do what we're doing fully and with heartfelt thoroughness, the less we're going to feel oppressed at the end of the day. Now, that might sound very idealistic, but if you look at how karma works, how your heart works, you can see that one does have to take responsibility for the way one does things. And that's not to say I love dusting or something. That's a bit sentimental, or that you kind of do your little dusting exercise and take 5 hours to dust your living room. Life's never going to be that. When the dusting, you try to do it quickly, sure, but to do it for the sake of doing it, see what I mean? I think that would be a really good exercise to develop. And I'm pretty confident that if you put that kind of intention into your life, in the way you're actually doing things, that you get more and more mindful around an issue like that. And so in a contemplative lay life, what one could do is not merely sitting, once or twice a day or whatever, but also kind of take some kind of exercise that you could integrate into your ordinary life. Things that actually made you more mindful and more careful. Because the secret really is a sense of being present with what you're doing. So that would mean you really look at the way you approach the world of dharmas, the way you approach work, the way you approach projects. Obviously, like lots, to do retreats periodically is very, very helpful. I think it's very important. Self-retreats are just periods of stopping. Good friendships, as I mentioned, those are very important. The whole teaching around precepts, Right? So precepts are the they're what protect you. They're your friends. That like precepts in Buddhism aren't the kind of like they're not really meant to frighten you. Although if you're really going off, a bit of fear is good. You know, so if someone is about to steal our bell, I said, you know, if you do that, you're going to drop into hell. If he believes me, it's pretty good for him. I'm sure he won't. But so you have, like, religion uses fear, right, doesn't it? It uses fear. So, like, in Buddhism, we have some very interesting hell realms. You know, some really, if you see some of the Thai temples where they have paintings of these hell realms, they look really awful. So why does religion do that? Are there actually these hell realms? Yeah? Don't know. So do these burning cauldrons exist somewhere? Don't know. But if a person is kind of grossly immoral, and you could just persuade them to say, hey, you know, you're going to burn. That maybe the person stops doing it. It would be a good use of fear. Right? But the downside of that is, of course, is that religion is related with fear. So that the only reason one kind of acts morally is out of fear. But that's, you know, that the fear part's like the way you train your puppy. You know, it's like, puppy, if you do it on the rug, you're out. Right? Oh, and the puppy, okay. But, you know, once you've got a bit of maturity, you don't have to do puppy religion anymore. You don't have to do puppy training. Because you see in your own heart what hell is. You know, you really see what the result of immoral behavior is, going outside the precepts is. So then the precepts become your friends because they're really helping you, reminding you, be careful. That's, you know, if you go outside those boundaries, it's going to get messy. So the way one uses precepts is a kind of guidelines, and they're usually like precepts become more and more refined. So you know, like say if someone's into kind of killing humans, then you don't worry about them killing possums. Yeah, go for the possums, but lay low on the humans for a while. Then when they've given up on humans, maybe you work on possums. Right? And then when they've given up on possums, you see, you know, flies aren't so bad either. You kind of refine it down until they really see what it means to be compassionate to all sentient beings. So there's a kind of possibility of refining down the precepts. Now, the speech one, I think, is a brilliant framework for mindfulness, the way that the right speech precept is presented. So right speech is speech which is truthful, speech which is beautiful, speech which is in concord, and speech which is according to Dhamma. And wrong speech is speech which is lying, speech which is harsh, like swearing, speech which is which divides society, which is divisive, and speech which is just downright stupid. So, where does humor come into that? Well, I think if humor is based upon time and place, and it doesn't hurt other people, you know, it's with a sense of irony, it seems quite appropriate. But when humor is used at the expense of other people and hurts them, then that would be inappropriate, wouldn't it? But anyway, if you take that on as a kind of mindful discipline, right speech, and this is how one uses precepts and training rules, well, you have this, and this is like our monastic system, it's called a system of training rules we have. Someone's giving this sort of general training rules around right speech. So in the morning you read about it. You go to your text and you read about right speech. And when you read about something, that sets up an intention in your mind. It sets up a consideration in your mind for the day, doesn't it? And even though one has read it and one understands it at a kind of intellectual, right speech, I'm supposed to practice right speech, the actual awakening to the factors of right speech sometimes needs stimulation. That's why you read. That's why you can't always have to read Dharma. Not because you don't know it, it's because you forget it. Not that you don't really understand right, it's not so difficult, is it, right speech? It's just that we forget to be mindful. So how do we remember to be mindful? We have to make intentions to be mindful. If you make intentions, those intentions will somehow manifest. So if I make intentions to be angry, I'll be angry. Anger begets anger, doesn't it? And if I make intentions to be aware, I'll be aware. So read me a little bit on right speech. I read right speech. Alright, get it, Mama? Right. Wrong speech. And then that sets up a possibility for more mindfulness in the day. So I'm walking through my life in the day and I find myself maybe gossiping about someone. Because I have actually made a determination and a really sincere intention to practice right speech, then the precept pops up, says right speech is speaking in concord, wrong speech is speaking divisively. And what that does for me, it helps me to see where I'm coming from. It helps me to see maybe I'm coming from some ego place. I want to look cool, so I put the other people down. Or I want to manipulate this person and wow, look at that. Or I'm coming from fear, or I'm coming from pride, or I'm coming from jealousy, or whatever it is. I see that the root of this particular wrong speech is not wholesome. It's not conducive to my welfare or the welfare of others. I become more mindful. And as I become more mindful, I also begin to see what the result of wrong speech is. So maybe I go and I rip someone down, and then I'm watching my heart, and I'm more aware, and I feel that actually now I'm afraid of that person I ripped down. Now look at that fear. Oh, I'm afraid that they'll find out that I ripped them down. Oh, I see, fear. So with wrong speech, there's fear. Oh, I see. So I begin to see that the karmic result of being heedless around speech, and then of course there's a kind of an energy, a motivation to practice right speech, because I don't want to suffer. So the right speech isn't just coming from being a good Buddhist in some kind of a idea way, but it's from the real love of truth, the real wanting to be free from suffering and not wanting to hurt others. And that's how you use Dharma. You use Dharma in that very kind of contemplative way. Where the Buddhist teaching would fail is if we just left it at an intellectual level. You know, I could have a kind of nodding agreement about, yeah, that makes sense. But actually, the integration of all these ideas and concepts into the heart, and then the use of them as a vehicle for investigation and reflection, and hence a vehicle for freedom, is the contemplative part of Buddhism. So in Buddhism we say there's study, there's practice, and there's insight, there's penetration. So study is necessary. Like, you have to study the precepts, and you have to kind of, as I was saying to someone in the afternoon, you have to understand the project. What's the Buddhist project about? Why? What was the Buddhist realization? What was the Buddhist realization? And why did he set out the Noble Eightfold Path? How does it fit into the Four Noble Truths? And where does right speech fit into that? And where does right concentration fit into that? So you have an intellectual feeling for the project. Yeah? You align your mind with the Buddha's mind intellectually. That's not freedom yet, right? But it gives you the right approach. Now, if you see the logic of that, you have to see the logic of that and say, I see why he talks about it. That makes sense, yeah. Then the next task is to live it, to kind of really use these ideas and begin to implement them in your daily life. So that's practice. Practice isn't just watching your nose. Right? It's obviously a bit more profound than that. It's the whole business of the Eightfold Path. And so study is necessary, but the, and then practice of that study, as it were, practice of the path, where you're really contemplating, like right effort, the effort to sustain the wholesome, to get more wholesome things into consciousness, to abandon the unwholesome, to prevent the unwholesome coming. Think about that right effort, and you begin to integrate that. And then from all of that, you're putting the path in action, as it were. Then there's insight, because you're making all the factors for insight to be there. And then the intellectual then becomes heartfelt, right? And then you become Dhamma. You see like the Buddha sees. It's no longer just agreeing with him. It's more like being in the same way that he is. Yeah? You become Dhamma. So the Buddha would say, when you've seen the Dhamma, you've seen me. And this can only be done through a real... through a kind of intelligence, which is not simply the accumulation of information. You know, it's a kind of intelligence that you can apply to your own conditioning. And each of us has a particular, you know, we have a unique kind of problem we have to work out, or set of problems that we have to work out. We each have a kind of unique set of gifts and possibilities that we're all working with. And so the project, of course, comes back to suffering. And the end of suffering, that's the basic project. So if you've taken those ideas and you've tried to study them, and you know, you've read some commentaries, maybe you've read a few texts, you've read maybe what Ajahn Sumedho says, or Ajahn Chah, and heard a few talks, and you get a general feeling for Four Noble Truths. And then you start to try to integrate that. So when you're suffering, all right, now I can take up the project. And the good thing about the project is that we tend to suffer quite a bit. So you can always pick up the project. And suffering is maybe too heavy a word. Ajahn Taneeswara likes to use the word stress. It kind of fits into modern culture. Discontent, stress, suffering, dissatisfaction, lack of fulfillment, whatever you want. But that sense of lack, or there's something wrong, or there's something missing, and that's the sign that you really have to go to. Now, the worldly mind, when the sign of suffering comes up, the worldly mind seeks a compensation, seeks to become something, seeks to get rid of that, annihilated, distracted, absorbed into some sense experience, and those are compensations which don't really liberate. They're the scratching that doesn't put an end to the disease. So you have this feeling of stress, which is the itching, right? And then you always have that option. Do you go for the compensation and scratch, or do you really look at the feeling of itching? Do you really go to the sign of suffering? If you go to the sign of suffering, then you'll also begin to see that the cause of suffering is this craving. The craving to not have what's going on, or to have something else. This feeling of lack, this feeling of this, you know. And if you can get a hold of the craving, right, then you've really understood the project. Because if you can see the craving, then in the knowing of the craving will cease, because you're not attached to it. And that's the end of the project, the ending of craving. But if the sign of suffering comes up, and you seek compensations, then it'll come up again. Fair enough. And it'll keep knocking on your door. You know, and then one day you'll hopefully see that the compensation is really not where it's at. And that's a kind of a disillusionment which comes in the heart with compensations. Just that, oh, I've been there. It's rather like the child, you know, is fascinated with the Lego set or the sandbox, and then the grown-up is fascinated with a jaguar, and eventually, you know, the whole sense of being fascinated with the khandhas begins to drop away, and one is more interested in, well, what is the cause of suffering? Why can't I be at peace? What is the sense of lack? And then you really start to go to the heart of the matter. You really go to the heart of the matter. That takes fortitude. Sometimes, you know, we need to get backed against the wall where we just have no escape routes. And the suffering, kind of in-your-face suffering, until we're willing to look at it. But sometimes not. Sometimes we just notice it. So that the wonder, I think the really wonderful thing of this teaching is that it's not saying you have to become anything. It's saying you have to understand something, and it's something that we all are engaged with, suffering, with discontent or stress. So that's why one has to bring it on board. One has to welcome it into the heart as an object of contemplation. Not as a kind of martyrdom. Oh, you know, okay, now I'm practicing Buddhism, I'm suffering. That's not mindfulness. Right? It's like, okay, alright, this is a chance now. Look at this feeling. To do that, you know, to do that, you need some objectivity in the mind, don't you? Right? And this is where the meditative mind is of great importance, because if there's no objectivity, if there's no space around the stress, then life seems like it's just, that's normal. It's just normal to be unhappy. It's just, and it's like a dark cloud that one is always in, and no one has no distance around it. So that's why samadhi, wholesome states of mind like metta, gratitude, calmness, tranquility, are the basis for good insight. If life becomes so busy for you, and you are so just taken, overwhelmed, say, by sense experience, that you're just constantly reacting, right? You know, anything presses your button, you get angry, whatever, then you need a rest. Because that's the sign. There's no more space, there's no more samadhi, and any old thing can trigger you off. And it's not that there's something, you know, wrong with you as a human being, as per se. It's just, I mean, your system's too tired, too worn out. And if you see anyone like that in your family or friends who are just kind of really snappy, realize it's not so much them as that their hearts need a bit of a rest. And that's always kind of difficult, because when a person is really kind of stressed out or in a distressed situation, then they tend to attract more negativity because they are very reactive. And yet what they need is more space and kindness. Tomorrow, wherever you're going, some few people are staying here for a while, but again, as I said earlier today, I think, try to use that space where between now and when you enter into your normal family work life, and as you enter into it, just see what kind of self arises with other people, with other situations. Really get a hold of that, because you can get a lot of insight around that time of transition. So tomorrow, again, we'll have the usual sitting at 6, and then, as I mentioned earlier, if we could meet at 8:30 rather than 9, and then those who want to take the 5 precepts, we can do that, maybe some closing thoughts, and then we'll make a circle and just have a bit of a sharing, and finish it off probably by 10 o'clock. And I'll have a look at these questions tomorrow. Okay, finish there.
Annamo varadhammagathaya sarukaram yadamase sa sa